We'll come to order. Justice Appropriations meeting is in order, and Rosa, please call the roll.
Chair Brennan.
Here.
Vice Chair Smith.
Here.
Ranking Member Valdez.
Present.
Representatives Beltran.
Here.
Bracy Davis.
Here.
Campbell.
Here.
Duggan, excused. Fabricio.
Here.
Gottlieb.
Here.
Jacques.
Here.
Redondo.
Here.
Saroy, excused. Snyder.
Here.
Stark.
Here.
Waldron.
Here.
A quorum is present, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Rosa. As always, please ensure that communication devices are turned off and or placed on silent, and ask everyone to fill out a speaker card and get it to us if you wish to appear. We do want to start late today. Thank you, members, for being here at this late afternoon meeting. I really appreciate it. Today's agenda will consist of two member bills under consideration before us today, followed by a presentation on the multi-year facilities master plan study completed by KPMG in consultation with the Department of Management Services and the Department of Corrections. With this late beginning to our meeting, y'all don't want to hear from me, so let's get underway and we'll get started. We'll start with Representative Porras, House Bill 713. Welcome, sir. You're recognized to present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Vice Chair, and Ranking Member. Members, today we have a very simple bill. HB 713 would create a felony of the third degree anyone who knowingly would cause or attempt to cause any person to come into contact with blood, urine, feces, and seminal fluid. And that is the bill, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. I see no amendments. Members, do we have any questions for the presenter? Any questions? Rep. Campbell, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome, Representative. Could you please elaborate or give some situations to put into context why this bill is needed or what is occurring now for this bill to be brought forth?
You're recognized, Rep.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Rep. Campbell, for that question. So before this bill, it was only a misdemeanor for an adult. In previous statute, it was only a felony to if these fluids or materials were purposefully put on a child. But this bill would expand that to anyone, obviously, over the age of 18, and a child would be committing a felony. This is needed also because not just in Miami-Dade County, where I'm from, but also in Tampa Bay, where my prime co, who cannot be here, Rep. Alvarez, is from. We've had several of these cases of people repeatedly committing these crimes. So we want to make sure we try to prevent that and put people to get held accountable for these crimes.
Ranking Member, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and good afternoon, Representative Porras. You mentioned the Tampa Bay area. Can you give me an example of where that's happening in my area?
Absolutely. So I've spoken with Rep. Alvarez, and pardon me, one second, I'm looking for the name. Your state attorney, Ms. Susie Lopez. She's brought to us several cases, and I'd be more than happy to show you all the court proceedings after the committee if I can.
Anyone else in questions? Okay. Seeing none, public testimony.
We got one.
You had a question? Okay. We'll go back. Representative Fabricio, Chairman Fabricio, you're recognized.
Representative, thank you for bringing this good bill. What is the fiscal impact on flinging these products?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So this bill, the only fiscal impact would obviously be, you know, the new creation of this felony. You know, with this felony would be an indeterminate impact on the jail and prison beds, obviously, of people who would be committing this crime. I would hope it's not that many people that do this, but obviously there is an indeterminate amount of fiscal impact.
Back to you, Ranking Member Valdez.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. In considering voting on this bill, do you think that there might be a new form of rape if you're over the age of 18? Should, in a consensual, I'm trying to put this, y'all make me have the toughest conversations publicly, my goodness. So if you have a consensual act that's happening, and somehow or another things go awry, and they get upset the next day, and no longer do I like you. Now, I'm gonna say you raped me because you put seminal fluid, gosh, Lord have mercy, on my body. How do you prove whether, I guess it's up to the lawyers, but these are some of the unintended consequences, I think, that will come up when we, I know this is not, this is funny, but it's not funny because this is real. And we're talking about creating more felonies and things of that nature without really thinking through. So how will that impact cases moving forward? I mean, I can think of one right now that is pending.
Okay, let's stop it there.
So I'm trying
to
figure out
what, question.
Yeah, I did. So y'all just make me have the toughest conversations about subjects that really, wow.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Ranking Member. I'm not an attorney, so I'll be very frank with you. However, I do think it would probably be up to a court or a jury to decide what consent, you know, where does consent start and where does consent end when it comes to some of these crimes. But for the purposes of this bill, obviously it'd be, you know, throwing, tossing, projecting, or expelling. So that could include also if somebody just tossed it or, you know. But I do understand where you're coming from.
Okay. Anyone else? All right. Appearance card-wise, we have Barney Bishop, Florida Smart Justice Alliance. He is waving in support. I don't see anything else. Members, we are in debate. Anybody in debate? No debate? Report is you recognize closed.
I'll just wave closed, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Having closed on the bill, Rosa, please call the roll.
Chair Brennan?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith?
Yes.
Ranking Member Valdez?
No.
Representatives Beltran?
Yes.
Gracie Davis?
Yes.
Campbell?
Yes.
Duggan? Fabricio?
Yes.
Gottlieb?
Yes.
Jacques?
Yes.
Redondo?
Yes.
Saroy? Snyder?
Yes.
Stark?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
12 yeas, 1 nay.
Thank you, Rosa. By your vote, the bill is reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome. Next, we'll move on to House Bill 353, Alternative Headquarters for District Court Judges by Representative Maney. Welcome, sir. You are recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Ranking Member, I appreciate you. Members of the committee, thanks for having me. Before I get started, Chairman, I want to thank you for putting this case on the agenda, or this bill on the agenda.
You're welcome, Judge.
Thank you. After the possible salaciousness of the last bill, I'm a little self-conscious in trying to present this one. What may not be quite as interesting. But in 2020, the legislature authorized judges of the district courts of appeal to have an alternate headquarters, which would serve as their private chambers in their county of residence. This bill, if passed, will create another option for the judges to have their alternate headquarters in an adjacent county, to a neighboring county, to their county of residence. The requirements remain the same. It has to be more, the residence has to be more than 50 miles from their main headquarters. Their travel is reimbursed to their main courthouse from the nearest place, so they don't get any financial boost from having an alternate headquarters. Mr. Chair, that's the bill.
Thank you, sir. I see no amendments. Members, do we have any questions? Any questions? Apparently he presented that case pretty well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
I see no public testimony. Oh, got one. Well, welcome Judge Clay Roberts from the Florida Conference of District Court Appeals judges. He is just waving in support. Thank you for being here, sir. I see no others. Members, anybody in debate? Okay, no debate. Representative Maney, you recognize close on House Bill 353.
Waive close, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, sir. Having closed on the bill, Rosa, please call the roll.
Chair Brannon?
Yes.
Vice Chair Smith? Ranking Member Valdez?
Yes.
Representatives Beltran?
Yes.
Gracie Davis?
Yes.
Campbell?
Yes.
Duggan? Fabricio?
Yes.
Gottlieb?
Yes.
Jacques?
Yes.
Redondo?
Yes.
Saroy? Snyder?
Yes.
Stark?
Yes.
Waldron?
Yes.
12 yeas, 0 nays.
Thank you, Rosa. By your vote, show the bill is reported favorably. Congratulations.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, committee.
That concludes our bill portion this afternoon. We'll now move into our presentation. So, members, we have a presentation, a pretty important one today. Funding was provided in fiscal year 2022-23 in the General Appropriations Act within the Department of Management Services to contract for an independent third-party consulting firm to conduct a review of state-operated correctional facilities and institutions and develop a multi-year master plan to address the potential repair, maintenance, or replacement of state-operated institutions. The plan was also required to include information on the labor pool and availability of workforces for staffing those facilities. The plan was completed and recently submitted to the governor, the president of the Senate, and the speaker of the House of Representatives as required by proviso. Here today to present information from the plan are members of the KPMG team, who is a consulting firm procured to complete the study in consultation with the Department of Management Services and the Florida Department of Corrections. Members of the team here today to present include Bill Zizek, partner with KPMG US, Chad Poppel, principal KPMG US, Lawrence Spinetta, director KPMG US, and Julie Walburn, manager KPMG US. So we have a partner, a principal, a director, and a manager. We've got it covered. Without further delay, you may start your presentation. Welcome back, sir. Good to see you again.
How's that?
Good.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Chad Poppel. Thank you for the introduction, sir. I'm a leader on our Florida account team, and it's an honor to be here today with you all. We appreciated the invitation to present an overview of the 20-year corrections master plan that we've developed over the last 15 months. As the committee should know, that the final report was submitted. It should be circulating now. KPMG is a consulting firm with a global presence, and we have a very mature justice and public safety practice that led this engagement. You're going to hear from the project's leaders today as they walk through the current state of Florida's correction system and lay out options for a path forward over the next two decades. We sincerely appreciate the trust you've placed in us to assist the state with this significant undertaking. Introduction's already been made, but joining me today is Bill Zizek. He's the partner who leads KPMG's justice and public safety practice. And as was mentioned, we have some team members that'll be supporting him. So, Mr. Chair, there'll be a few handoffs. Hopefully that's not a problem, and we look forward to doing the presentation and having some time for some Q&A with you all today.
Thank you.
Right. With your permission, I'll hand it to Bill.
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair, thank you, sir. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, our agenda today, as you see on the screen, includes first a synopsis of our scope and methodology. We're going to review the assessment of the current conditions and the challenges that we see facing the state. We're going to highlight three strategic options looking forward, and we're going to look at cost estimates related to each of those options. As the committee will appreciate, KPMG was selected in a competitive procurement by DMS. The project had, the RFQ called for assistance in three ways: developing a plan to address the repair, maintenance, replacement of FDC's correctional institutions. Second was identifying needs for safer, more efficient, and better suited capacity to serve a growing inmate populations with various special population needs. And the third was prioritizing those needs based on immediacy to stay abreast of the expected growth in Florida inmate populations. As you see depicted on the screen, the approach over the past 15 months has taken shape in three work streams. The first was assessing FDC's sites, all 153, 3,000 buildings, tens of thousands of components that we'll talk a little more about in a minute. Assessing staffing and population trends. From that significant data gathering and on-site observation effort across the state, we helped develop space and operational requirements using all available data. We identified strategic options with input from DMS and FDC working group members to ensure that it was practical and tangible in nature. And we've worked collectively to finalize forecasts and validating cost estimates to complete the master plan as submitted on December 27th. I'll note that the plan, 130 pages of it, here, including a variety of electronic files that accompany it that are in possession of the department and perhaps maybe members of this body, the work in there is performed under our consulting standards under the American Institute of CPAs. It's not engineering, architectural, or legal in its nature. The scale of the data gathering effort that you see depicted here was immense, covering 153 facilities. I mentioned over 3,000 buildings in the FDC portfolio. This includes prisons, medical facilities, work camps, work release centers, including whether they were open or closed at the time of our review. And in addition to hundreds of pages of interim and financial analysis, final analysis and forecasts, we have also built a set of customized tools for ongoing use by DMS and FDC staff so that they can keep the forecasts in the master plan as living insights, remain dynamic as decisions are made, and conditions realistically will evolve over time. Here I'll underscore our sincere gratitude for the daily coordination with DMS, FDC in terms of access to data, personnel, facilities, as well as their diligent review of hundreds of pages of interim reports and spreadsheets. Staff from various branches of both DMS and FDC came together for workshops to validate our assumptions, our analysis, and the strategies that underpin the plan. So I'll now turn to Dr. Lawrence Spinetta to cover the challenges of the current state that we observed. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'll ask Mr. Spinetta to come up.
Thank you, Bill.
Recognize.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Lawrence Spinetta. As Bill mentioned, I'm a director with KPMG. I specialize in corrections, and in a previous career, I served in the Air Force and I'm a retired colonel. After visiting every FDC correctional facility to assess conditions, interviewing wardens and staff, and analyzing over 1,500 data files, we noted the following. First, the forecasted inmate population is growing. Second, there's immediate capital and FDC infrastructure modernization needs. Third, despite welcome and much-needed investments in FDC staffing in recent years, the department continues to face persistent staff vacancy and turnover challenges. Lastly, the FDC also faces safety and security challenges, not just for its inmates, but also for its staff. And we'll cover each of these items in turn. Leveraging data provided by the state, our team developed a model to predict the inmate population. The upper line on the graph shows a high-end growth case where the population increases at a rate that's similar to what Florida experienced for 20 years from 1990 to 2010. The lower line is based off of more recent population growth trends. The analytics project inmate numbers rising from 85,000 to over 107,000 in 2042. Additionally, the forecast predicts a significant growth in inpatient medical needs due to a graying population and increased substance abuse and mental health challenges. All told, FDC is on track to exceed its capacity, which is notably limited by staffing challenges, in the coming years. We'll talk more about critical staffing shortly, but first I wanted to introduce my colleague Darren to cover more about facility conditions.
Good afternoon.
Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Darren Fancher. I'm a subcontractor to KPMG. I'm with the Meridium Group here out of Tallahassee. I am an engineer by trade, and my experience ranges in engineering, facility management, condition assessments, both in the public and private sectors. So the site visits included condition assessments of all existing components and systems and equipment. These assessments were organized at the building level. So for example, if there were 60 separate buildings at a given site, then we provided an assessment of all existing components, systems, and equipment for each of those 60 buildings individually. The result is a robust assessment database that can be utilized for analysis by any building element statewide or any other data element within. During the site assessments, we assigned a condition rating to each and every system and component. A scale of 1 to 5 was used. So 1 is like new condition, a rating of 2 is good condition showing minor wear, a rating of 3 was fair condition showing moderate wear, a rating of 4 was poor condition indicating extensive wear and really an end of life issue, and then a rating of 5 was a failure condition, meaning it was no longer operational. We next applied unit costs to every system and component that was assessed, utilizing current industry cost expectations from a national database, while forward projecting expected costs across the whole 20-year planning horizon based on BOMA, that's the Building Owners and Managers Association, and ASHRAE, that's the Society of Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers. We use those standards regarding useful life. The cost for the systems and component with a rating of 4, which was poor condition, or 5, which was failure condition, or what we consider to be FDC's immediate capital needs. We then developed a facility condition index for each site, and that is the ratio of those immediate capital needs to the total capital needs that will come through over the whole planning period. So this ratio is an indication of facility condition because it represents the overall level of repair immediacy for each site. And so finally, we then organize the sites into the standard convention of condition index groups. So for example, the sites in the critical category, for the sites in the critical category, that means more than 60% of the total capital needs identified were immediate in nature. Okay, so here we can see how the condition indexes of FDC sites are distributed across the range of overall condition. So based on this, we can see that FDC has slightly more sites and square footage in the excellent and good categories than exists in the critical and poor categories. And as it happens, and this is something we covered in detail in the master plan, there is a strong correlation between overall condition, age, and design prototype in the FDC portfolio. For example, the excellent category is occupied by FDC's newest prototype, while the critical and poor categories are occupied by FDC's oldest sites, both their prototypical old sites and their non-prototypical or unique sites. Those unique sites meaning they're unlike any other in the state system. All right, here are some sample photos of various components and systems from around the state. And during the several-month process of conducting all the site visits, we took in excess of 20,000 photographs, and this is just a sample of them. So looking at the top left, that is a roofing membrane failure that's at the Central Florida Reception Center main unit. If you look at the top center, you're seeing exterior corrosion. That's at Sago Palm Reentry Center. In the top right, those are really inoperable windows over at Florida State Prison. Now, if you look at the bottom left, that's also at Sago Palm Reentry Center. That's corrosion. It's on an exterior window. I'm sure that corrosion started on the exterior and worked its way inside. So on the bottom center here, you'll see that is a Spalling stucco condition that happens to be over at the Columbia main unit. And that's a common occurrence we saw on that particular prototype of housing unit across the state. Okay, so on that particular prototype, we're seeing that level of Spalling. So in that condition, moisture has gotten in behind the stucco and rusted out the mesh, and it's Spalling off. Okay. And then the bottom right, you're seeing some aging and leaking mechanical equipment that's over at Apalachee Correctional Institution. And Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it back over to Lawrence Spinetta to discuss staffing.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. As I mentioned earlier, FTC needs to simultaneously solve both infrastructure and staffing challenges to achieve sustainable operations in the delivery of its mandated mission. A significant number of facilities have vacancy rates over 20%, which has caused FTC to close a number of dorms. Additionally, staff turnover rates now exceed 27%, which hurts the department in multiple ways. First, high turnover means the department loses significant experience every year. Second, the churn means the department bears significant training burdens, having to retrain over a quarter of its workforce annually. And lastly, trainees and trainers are counted against positions, but are not available to staff inmate-facing positions. Indeed, high vacancy rates have caused the department to leave over 85,000 shifts for level one posts unfilled last year. To make matters worse, analysis of the department's shift relief factor suggests the FTC now needs 23% more correctional officers to cover its existing posts. And with that, with your permission, Mr. Chair, I'll invite Mr. Zizek back up to talk about different options.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So with an assessment of current issues in mind, we worked with department leaders to define and validate three strategic options. You'll see here we titled those modernize, number one, manage and mitigate, that each address those challenges of the current path we discussed in a more sustainable manner. I'd like to commend the department here for its resilience in managing these physical plant and operational challenges with the resources available to them. As an example, with the support of the legislature, the department has cut those vacancy rates that you've seen on the previous slide in half with targeted recruitment and retention bonuses. But certainly more will be called for in the plan that we've delivered. Each of our options here, and you see on the right, seeks to first reopen closed capacity, about 11,000 beds or so that are closed today, and put in drop-in dorms on existing sites to afford the state a necessary bridge to accommodate the lead times to bringing any newly built capacity online. Reopening closed capacity, of course, depends heavily on first, staff attraction and retention through the various incentives we'll discuss. Second, investment in the capital needs to reopen and function safely. And third, modernizing what we call the key enablers, such as could be heating and cooling or connectivity or inmate programming and recreation spaces. The options vary in time scale as to when, how much, and exactly what type of capacity to build. But in the initial 5 to 7 year time frame, all options truly depend on staffing to reopen that closed capacity and operate those newly built dorms, and of course, larger campuses that could be built thereafter. Newly built capacity, in turn, allows the state to consider closing aging, more costly facilities starting in a window of about 8 to 10 years from now, and therefore avoid significant capital and operational costs in the periods after. Importantly, each of these options keeps the state at or above the minimum needed capacity to accommodate the expected increases in the inmate populations across the planning horizon, and offers a different profile of investment, as well as cost and risk avoidance for the state to consider. Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'll hand it back to Lawrence to cover the first option. Thank you, sir.
Option one allows the department the most flexibility to modernize its operations. Overall, it calls for building 3 prisons and 2 hospitals over 20 years, while closing 4 older prisons that are difficult to staff and have high deferred maintenance costs. Before I go into detail, let me start by explaining the graph. The blue line charts total capacity over time. The black dash and dotted lines, as you saw earlier in the presentation, represent the inmate population forecasts. The bottom of the chart outlines key decision points, which are represented by stars. All 3 strategic options begin with a pink star, a decision today whether to proceed with initiatives to fix staff and modernize FDC facilities. That means first, funding the immediate capital needs that Darren outlined earlier. Second, providing additional staff hiring incentives. And third, investing in critical enablers to include technological improvements such as WAN, LAN, and camera systems and HVAC systems. Additionally, option one begins with a decision today to build a new prison and a new hospital, which we anticipate will come operational around 2029 to 2030 based off of construction lead times. Meanwhile, the department will need to redouble its effort to bolster staffing, as Bill mentioned, and reopen closed capacity over the next 7 years, which means reopening work camps and closed dorms while building new dorms at existing facilities. 2 additional decision points you'll see on the slide are to build new facilities that are spaced every 6 years, one in 2030 and the other in 2036, which would allow progressively closing older facilities. I'll note that we've provided the department with several analytical tools to adjust the master plan if the inmate population differs from our forecast. So, for example, if there are fewer inmates than our forecast, the department can simply move or expedite modernization, moving closures earlier to save more money over the longer term. And with that, Mr. Chair, with your permission, I'll invite my colleague Alex up to talk about modern facility and design concepts.
Thank you, sir.
Mr. Chair, Alex Rodriguez with HOK Architects in Tampa. I am an architect that's primarily focused on justice and correctional design. And I'm here to basically explain the facility concepts that we mentioned in these options. There are several benefits that more modern campus-style prototypes bring to the Department of Corrections. And I'd like to go ahead and list them out. First, they add much-needed secure beds and capacity that they currently have at this point. Second, it'll definitely provide a safer environment for staff, inmates, visitors, and all stakeholders in the system. Third, the efficient design will allow the staff to focus on other required areas besides managing inmate movement. Fourth, staff turnover will definitely be shown to greatly improve with new facilities. Also, in regards to cost, modern construction systems will reduce the need for intensive maintenance and definitely reduce short-term costs related to those maintenance costs. Also, access to broadband and other technologies will be greatly improved. Facilities will be sustainable and far more resource and energy efficient, therefore saving more costs. And lastly, enable inmates to get better and more frequent access to programs and healthcare. And with that, I'll go ahead and pass it on to Julie.
Thank you, Alex. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Julie Walburn. As you heard earlier, I'm a manager with KPMG. Prior to joining the firm, I spent 28 years in public service in a large state jurisdiction. The large majority of that was directly in a leadership role, both in the adult and in the juvenile correctional systems. The inmate population in Florida is getting older, and with age comes increasingly complex health needs. Today, 29% of the inmates are now over 50 years old, and like the community, they require more inpatient health care. The proportion of inmates with routine health needs in the system is declining, while the proportion of those with chronic care and intensive health services is on the rise. Currently, the department is unable to provide enough inpatient care for its existing population. Today, there are approximately 1,150 inmates who need inpatient care, but there are only 1,121 inpatient beds available in the system. As a result, the department has been relying on short-term infirmary beds and community hospital beds, which come at an increased cost and pose more significant security risks. The department needs additional hospital beds today, and this inpatient housing deficit will continue to grow. By 2030, the forecasted deficit will grow to approximately 420 hospital beds. The need for additional hospital beds is compounded by a growing need for specialized housing outside of inpatient care. Many inmates require specialized housing beyond what general population housing can offer. For instance, there are 644 inmates in the system today that have advanced dementia, traumatic brain injury, or other complex health needs that need specialized housing to supplement the outpatient care provided today. While the need for this specialized housing isn't addressed through the building of a new hospital, it is a need the department is currently attempting to address and that could be accommodated once FDC adds prison capacity contemplated by option one of this plan. And with that, I'm going to turn it back over to Darren to cover options two and three.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Okay, thank you. So option two, which we're calling manage, is in many ways similar to option one, including reopening the closed capacity, building two new hospitals, and building one new prison by 2036. In other words, option two omits the decision point in 2036 to build the final new prison in 2041 and the possible closure decisions that may follow. The similarities between option one and option two, as well as option three, which we'll see in a minute, tells the same story, especially in the near term. And that story is the importance of addressing infrastructure and staffing, both of which lead to increased capacity. And so while option two costs less than option one, there are considerations to option two as well, such as a reduction in the avoided capital costs on immediate and overall capital needs. And moving on to option three. Option three, which we're calling mitigate, is the same as option two, except it does not include the new 4,800-bed prison and related closures beginning in 2030. This option does not envision the closure of any of the department's older prisons, although this option, like the other two, is just as dependent on recovering closed capacity through increased staffing and the construction of those drop-in housing units at existing sites. While option three costs the least, considerations for this option are no avoided capital and minimal clearance of the probable inmate population forecast, possibly leading to further capacity challenges. And the next slide. Here we can start to see the detail on the overall estimated cost structure of the master plan, with capital costs on the left and operational costs organized on the right. The estimated costs presented here are in 2023 dollars, to give you a present-day perspective for reference purposes. Although the estimated costs presented here are currently being validated and finalized, they have been validated and finalized, they include cost estimates and escalations across the entire planning horizon. Okay, and so I wanted to review some of those cost escalation assumptions, and those are as follows. For construction, we're utilizing an annual escalation of 4.38%. That's the Engineering News Records Building Cost Index. For energy costs, we're utilizing an annual escalation of 3.35%. That's based on the Department of Energy's annual energy outlook. For salaries and benefits, we're assuming an annual escalation of 3%. And then for healthcare contracts, we are assuming an annual escalation of 7%. And so let's start with the 20-year capital costs on the left, that is top left. We identified $2.2 billion in those immediate capital needs across the whole FDC system. That's all 153 sites. And that $2.2 billion is a subset of the $6 billion in total capital needs that we identified over the entire planning horizon. Some of the larger elements here include electrical systems and distributions, windows, plumbing systems, and locking control systems. The range shown here and in all five other sections that you see is the range of estimated costs across all three strategic options, you know, 1, 2, and 3. In this case, the range of $2.1 to $2.2 billion is narrow because any of FDC's older sites, which we believe are the sites most likely to be closed in the later years, either in 2033 or 2042, they will require some investment over time to remain operational until those points in time, thereby limiting the amount of avoided capital. And so investing in these immediate capital needs simply allows FDC to move from poor or failing conditions to fair or adequate levels, depending on the level of investment. And so on the center left, what you see there as key enabler costs, these are the key enablers. These are the innovation items we developed with substantial coordination with FDC and DMS. These range from the telecommunication wide area network, that's the WAN, and the local area network, that's the LAN, at each facility in the mitigate option, up to all items in that modernization category. Please note here that the HVAC item, the air conditioning item, includes window and electrical upgrades at those facilities. We're talking about inmate housing units where that capacity would be added. Okay, so that's included in that number. All right, and going to the bottom left, this is the build option. So the construction range estimated for new prison capacity, including the dorms at the existing sites across all three options, is $3.9 to $8.4 billion. This also included consideration for constructing additional staff housing across those sites as well. And so if we could switch over to the top right, this represents the estimated range in salaries and benefits to reopen FDC's closed capacity. This is the closed capacity at these existing sites. This includes reopening approximately 70% of FDC's beds that are not currently in capacity, while leaving three currently closed prisons closed for, you know, reserve capacity or what you would call swing space capacity. And on the center right, called staff, the drop-in units, this represents the same staffing need as it pertains to those drop-in dormitories. Again, these are those housing units that you would drop in on existing prison sites where they have the footprint to do it. Okay. And so for both sections, we have included the existing new hire bonus as well as an additional flexible bonus allotment of up to $5,000 to be used for sites with difficult missions, cost of living challenges, or other problematic labor market forces. And then moving finally to the bottom right, here is the range in salaries and benefits as it relates to new prisons and hospitals across all three strategic options. Please note that there may be a need for an additional 100 to 200 FTEs for each hospital should they be standalone and not located right next to a prison, like a new prison or an existing prison. Now, moving on to the cost forecast. In this slide, we are presenting the estimated costs for the construction and immediate capital needs in two ways. The chart on the left assumes directly funding both, while the chart on the right assumes bond financing. Hence, on the right, the distribution over a much longer time horizon. Please note that these scenarios are intended to be illustrative only, and the plan does not presume any particular financing option, and in fact lays out multiple financial strategies in the master plan that the state can consider. Both of these funding or appropriation strategies assume, on this chart, we're assuming all construction options. Okay, this is the strategic option number one, okay, the modernized option. And then they also assume spreading the $2.2 billion in immediate capital needs across 11 years. And that's just as a matter of practicality. This is one with the understanding that that level of expenditure can take time. Okay, so that's just an assumption we've built in. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to turn this back over to Bill Zizek to summarize the options.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on this slide, to summarize the estimated costs and the benefits of the option, here we see across the top the required capital investments over our 20-year horizon, all presented in 2023 dollars, which will require the state to fix, build, innovate at varying levels depending on the option selected. Now, if I could take a second and just on the options remind that there are some elements that are common across all three. Those include reopening nearly two-thirds of closed capacity starting in this coming year, work camps, closed dorms, adding dorms to drop-in sites. It includes making the decision in the next several months to start building a 600-bed hospital to come online in 2030, as you heard the population increasing very quickly there. A second new 300-bed hospital in 2035 to accommodate the additional growth that Julie talked about, and one new prison campus, 4,800-bed campus, to come online in 2036. Those four items are common across all three. Options one and two have additional items. Option two has a second prison coming online by 2030 and allows you to close select facilities with high immediate needs costs, and you'll see at the bottom some avoided spending related to option three in today's dollars, but it's over the 40-year period post-closure. Option one allows you to build a second new prison similar to option two in 2030, but adds a third prison in 2041. And of course, that can be toggled depending on how population actually materializes over the period. And it allows you to close the most facilities and replace them with new, modern, more efficient ones. And it accrues $6.7 billion in total avoided spending. So even though option one is the most expensive and requires the most investment at $11.9 billion, it generates the most avoided spending because you're closing things down. If population forecasts undershoot, which is a possibility, of course, given the uncertainty in any forecast, that will allow you to close more and drive up that avoided spending even further. You'll also see that there's an annual cost range of up to $400 million a year in the light blue italicized text to staff up reopened and newly built sites. And then, of course, $200 million a year to continue to provide medical services at a similar scope and per bed cost as FDC has today. The cumulative spending over the first 5 years, you'll see in option one under purple. So for the next 5 years, $3.9 billion in total cost, and again, delivers the most savings over the 40-year horizon. That includes, as you'll see, $1 billion in capital improvements, $200 million in energy and utility savings, as Alex mentioned, but significantly $5.5 billion in salaries and benefits. A lot of that cost will be shifted to staff those newly built facilities, but we're adding it up top, and so therefore we're subtracting it down
below.
Option two, requiring a total 20-year investment of $9 billion. Annual staffing costs a little less than option one, up to $300 million because you're not adding that third prison. And the five-year cumulative is $3.3 billion that you see there in purple in the middle of the screen, and the avoided spending of $5.1 billion. And even though option three still calls for building new and additional hospitals and prison capacity, as I mentioned, it requires only $6.3 billion over the 20-year planning horizon, staffing costs of $200 million, but the same medical costs as option one and two. So that's $1.9 billion in the first 5 years there that you see in purple. And again, zero avoided spending because we're not closing any facilities. But if population goes below the dotted lines, then that could result in some closures as well. So I'll point out again that these figures are all estimates. They will be impacted by evolving decisions, financial envelope decisions from legislative bodies, and real-world conditions year to year, underscoring why we are leaving a set of living tools. This is a point-in-time report, but you have living tools with the departments that can be adjusted to accommodate real-world circumstances. I'll also mention before we leave the numbers slide here that the benefits of each option go beyond the quantitative. These were also prepared with capacity, safety, flexibility, and efficiency in mind, not just the dollars. So finally, we turn to the path ahead to operationalize this plan, which entails the state making multiple decisions around financial aspects, capital program, size, shape, and scale, and the operational transformation aspects of this plan. As we detail in the document, there are a variety of financial strategies the state may deploy with any level investment that is decided upon. These will require robust financial modeling, sound commercial approach to the extent that non-public sources are used, and diligence in shaping and defining the specifications and the performance regimes of the contractors that might be part of any bidding cycles required to deliver. Those financial decisions will, of course, then flow into number two to shape the scope and scale of the capital program. This will require a robust capital program office function to manage both small and large-scale work planning. This function will mobilize the action to address the immediate capital needs. What are we fixing, small to large, prioritizing life safety, locking systems, etc.? But it'll also oversee the new build planning and performance monitoring to demonstrate and foster accountability and fidelity to this plan. And certainly such a strategic shift in correctional infrastructure will require an operational improvement effort that strives to optimize staffing and capacity, integrates technology innovations to improve efficiency, and builds and manages the dashboards and tools necessary to improve decision-making that we're leaving behind and demonstrate tangible improvements in real-world performance. The program called for in the master plan is clearly no small undertaking and may be among the largest capital programs and operational transformations that the state has indeed embarked upon. We've provided a number of considerations and recommendations within the plan to help guide the state's decisions on the path ahead. So in closing, Mr. Chair, we appreciate this opportunity to present this analysis to you and the members of the committee today, and we are sincerely grateful for collaborative in-depth involvement of the leadership and senior staff of both departments, FDC and DMS, in this process. And we, of course, stand ready to support the state on its decisions and next steps to drive these strategies into action. So that concludes our prepared remarks, Mr. Chair, and we'd be happy to respond to any questions that you or the members of the committee may have.
Thank you, sir. Thank you for your work, and thank you for the presentation from your team today. Members, we'll now move into questions. Start with Representative Fabrizio. The way we'll work it, ask the question and the team can figure out who the appropriate, most qualified person is to answer it.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for making this
presentation. Thank you for coming by my office earlier to show it to me ahead of time. If you would flip to the slide prior to this with the three options.
Yes, sir.
Thank you so much. With regard to option number one, it indicates total capital expenditure in the amount of $11.9 billion. I'm going to ask just a very short series of questions, Chair, if that's okay with you. Sir, did you indicate that that's present value?
Yes, sir. That's in 2023 dollars, yes, sir.
And over how much time would you project that money being spent?
Yes, sir. So there's a few layers. So the first layer, the $2.1 billion for fixing the immediate capital needs to bring critical and poor to adequate standards, we would envision that over a 10-year period. Could be longer, but 10 years we think would be the quickest as a matter of practicality. The innovate and the build numbers would be over the full 20-year horizon. And those could be staggered and adjusted, of course, depending on how circumstances change.
And so if that's a present value number, if we look at it over the course of 20 plus years, what do you believe, in your expert opinion, sir, would be the total expenditure to the state of Florida?
So we included in the report, it's the last page, page 130, it has the inflated values. Mr. Fancher mentioned that all the different costs have a different flavor of inflation given the forces of each market for construction and medical costs and staffing. So when we look at the 20 years and if we inflate it to year of expenditure dollars, that $11.9 billion goes to $17.2 billion to account for what we predict as will be inflation. Significant, especially in medical costs, including as well as in construction, and sourcing materials and construction labor. These, again, are just assumptions based on what we're experiencing now. But as you know, the volatility has made it very difficult to say for certain that will be the final number.
Thank you.
Yes, sir.
Ranking Member Valdez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for this detailed report. When we talked about the incarcerated constituents going up in your report, was the team able to assess if there would be any opportunity for those that maybe are in, you mentioned earlier, the older gentlemen or the older folks that are in the system, they're aging out, they're possibly not a threat to society, of maybe doing house arrest with them at their homes, if available, or things of that nature, to free up some of the rooms or the beds, if you will? Was that a conversation at all?
Take a shot at that. That's sort of policy, but go ahead.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair.
You can try. I know that's yes, sort of a it's hard for him to answer that question, I think, because
it's a lot of
in here. Yeah, I'll state, Madam American Member, that through the chair, that these forecasts assume no changes in policy or institution of those types of programs. And that was just by virtue of our scope. These just trend line more in terms of the population adjusted expectations.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am.
Follow up, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So you talked about also staff housing.
Yes, ma'am.
Or new staff housing. In your assessment, were existing staff housing included in there for remodeling or updating, hardening?
Short answer, Mr. Chair, is yes. That was. We've looked at that. Mr. Fancher will drill down on that in a second, as well as new staff housing that we've included in the cost elements.
Mr.
Fancher,
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Representative. So we built a staff housing model, okay, to coincide with the new prisons, as well as enhancing staff housing at existing sites, right? Remember, there are drop-in dorms and other things in the plan that would be going on, right? And so we looked at several options, right? So we tied that to what the staffing need would be to get back up, you know, to a really good staffing level, right? It was approximately 1,700 additional staffing, which is, you know, that much staff housing, that's quite a bit of staff housing, right? And so we looked at different options, whether it was from mobile homes to townhomes to duplexes to apartments and single-family homes, right? So we modeled different densities and added costs in for, you know, roadways and utility construction and things like that. So that's all contained in the master plan, right? So it was pretty targeted just to really helping staff recover, staffing levels recover. Okay.
I have another question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the facilities whose buildings aren't functional that you plan on closing down, is there a recommendation to tear those down and use that site to rebuild the new ones?
Recognize.
Mr. Chair. Madam Ranking Member, no, there is no, we don't opine on sort of the recommended disposition. There would be a number of potential outcomes, and a lot of states have gone through different ways of repurposing these buildings or tearing them down. The short answer is no.
Okay. Another question?
One more, then we'll go to somebody else.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So when we talked about the hospitals and the staffing of the hospitals, and again, this might be a policy question, but I'm wondering if by chance you had that conversation with the department, is it a recommendation that they would be state of Florida employees that manage and run that hospital, or are you recommending that that still be an outsourced procurement process type of through a third party?
Mr. Chair, Madam Ranking Member, we don't take a position on what model it is. We do cost it at the current per bed cost of the contracts in place, which have seen significant inflation over the years, and we work with the department to get that. And then we project that forward with a significant inflation factor, which even in non-inflationary times is well above inflation, as you know. So the short answer is no, we don't make a decision on whether it's outsourced or not. That cost envelope, though, should still give you a representative figure as to what the envelope may look like over the long term.
Quick follow-up on that, sir.
Thank you.
Is there like were you able to provide even an unbiased just comparison of what it would cost either or?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
We did not. That was it was not in our scope to look at in-source versus outsource. The assumption made was we would take the existing model per bed cost and project roll that forward.
Thank you very much.
Yes,
thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Redondo, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you could just go to, actually it's on this slide. I wanted to just kind of make a point about the three different options. The second bullet here says mitigates risk of potential lawsuits. Option two says mitigates the risk of lawsuits associated with overcrowding and inadequate facilities. So it's a little more targeted. And option three just says, path to potentially mitigate lawsuit risk. I notice a diminishing level of confidence in each of those options. And as a civil lawyer myself, I appreciated you coming by my office earlier. Could you just tell us a little bit about other states and their experiences where lawsuits were filed and class action lawsuits and kind of what the costs were to those states that face those issues?
Mr. Chair.
Recognize.
Representative, thank you for the question. Yes, there are some well-known cases that are ongoing with other large states, of which Florida is the third. With those other two states, we're not practicing law here, right? But we are well aware of the research and of the ongoing nature of those lawsuits. California being a prime example where there's been a longstanding federal intervention and receivership around the medical and mental health provision in that statewide system, and has resulted in well over $10 billion in, let's say, non-collaborative spending over the last 10-year period. Texas, as well, has faced litigation around the HVAC, air conditioning, for medically vulnerable inmate populations and making sure that they have access to what are called cold beds so that their medical conditions are not exacerbated. And that's been a longstanding case that they've been dealing with there. I don't have the figures of exactly what it's cost them because a lot of it is a management intervention of making sure the right people are in the right beds because they have limited cooling ability across their system. So it's more of a staffing and operational cost than sort of a direct outlay to third parties. Those are two examples, but there are many others that are ongoing and had demonstrable costs in addition to the workload associated with getting to something like a receivership and then having to manage through a receivership is a very time-intensive and staff-intensive and data-intensive exercise. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Anyone else? How many more you got? You're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. So I don't know if this was in the scope of your the contract, but were you able to assess the hiring practices and screening mechanisms to hire qualified Department of Correction employees?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question, Madam Ranking Member. So we looked at hiring practice insofar as when we did the labor market analysis, we had to target what are the age ranges and educational criteria that the department currently has. We did not make any recommendations regarding changing those criteria, but we looked at how well could the department access those labor pools so that you didn't build new facilities in areas, for instance, that you're not going to be able to compete with other forces in that labor market or due to high housing or cost of living issues. But in terms of hiring practices, we, of course, as mentioned, are recommending and included in the estimates some additional targeted bonus structures that would incentivize staff to not only in terms of the existing vacancy or retention issues of the facility, but where you have a difficult mission, you have difficult working conditions, or it's just been a persistently hard to staff location. While, as I mentioned, the department should be commended and the legislature has funded reduction of that vacancy rate, there are locations in the state that in that average of reducing it 50%, there's still some that are, you know, still very high and difficult. So in terms of that of a recruitment strategy, as well as staff housing from a retention strategy, I would say those impact hiring and retention practices, but we did not look at the specific criteria or make recommendations relative to those criteria. And I would say those are in line with what we see in other states at this time.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Anyone else? All right, well, thank you once again. Lots of material, lots of things to look at, think about, digest. But we appreciate your work, and we appreciate the folks being here today and your informative presentation. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, members.
All right, members, we're going to get out before 6 o'clock, thank goodness. This will conclude our meeting, and unless anybody has anything else, and I don't see anybody raising their hand, I'll go to Representative Redondo, and I guess you'll move that we'll rise. Without objection, this meeting is adjourned. Thank you.